Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to 88.5 KRFY this beautiful May 4th morning. And you are listening to The Morning Show with Chris and Susie Chris Bessler and Susie Perez.
Yeah, get that last name right, please, ma'am.
We're very happy to be here. We have, this is our Election Central interview
series that we're having here. Exactly. Yes. And today we invited in the Idaho Senate candidates. We have one with us, Sean Keel. Hi, Sean.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming. We did invite Glenn Rohr, your opponent, and Glenn declined to come in. And we're going to read a short statement from him, but we're going to focus most of the hour on you with some questions, of course, Sean.
I'm looking forward to being here.
Okay.
It gives a chance for our listeners to continue to become informed about this important primary May 17th election that's coming up, because when you're informed and you have more information directly from the source, it's always a good thing. And that's why KRFY and The Morning Show on Wednesdays are hosting these interviews. Before we get to that, though, the National Weather Service, it's kind of an interesting weather forecast today. We have a 20% chance of slight showers between 11 and 1 p.m., and then a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms after 1 p.m. That's a 20% chance. High today, it says 79. Mm-hmm. And low tonight, a 30% chance of showers with a low of 53. Thursday, heavy rain, 60% chance, high of 74. Thursday night, chance of thunderstorms, then slight chance of showers, low 49. But let's get over to Saturday and Sunday, high 80 and high of 79 on Sunday. So, sunny skies.
Sunny skies, and unseasonably warm, actually. We're getting kind of like June weather in May, so enjoy that. Other things going on outside, the sunrise was at 5:22 a.m. this morning. It's going to set at 8:03 p.m. And over the past 7 days, as we keep gaining daylight, we've garnered another 22 minutes a day of daylight. So we're getting those beautiful long days of summer now.
Yeah, I was awake at 4 o'clock and it was light out.
Yeah.
It was strange.
It gets us all up early, doesn't it?
The farmers in us, right?
The lake level is at 2056.15 feet. That's up almost 1 foot in the past 7 days, and the lake will continue to rise now as we are approaching full pool. We're still about 6 feet down from full pool level. The stream flows, Priest River is flowing very high now. It's at 4,800 CFS, although that's actually down a little bit, about 800 CFS in the past 7 days. The Moyet River is flowing at 1980 CFS. That's down also the past 7 days by about 900 CFS. However, those are both really good levels for whitewater people. And also, we have the new moon on Friday. So the moon's been waning, and it'll be completely dark Friday.
When is the full moon then? 15 days after that?
No, it's about 2 weeks after that.
Okay.
Yeah, 14 days after that. And what else has been going on around town?
I was hoping you'd ask me that, Chris, because we here at KRFY are gearing up big time for the benefit concert that's being held at the Panada this Friday night. And it is a benefit for KRFY, our very own community radio station right here at 88.5. And, you know, I just have to say the Little Smokies are the featured band, and they are amazing. We'll be playing some of their music a little bit later and probably throughout the day, because tickets are now on sale and you can get those. You can call us here at 265-2992. I'm here all day today, and I'd be happy to sell tickets right out of the studio. But this bluegrass band, we have an opener of Doug Bond and Terry Ludeker. Amazing fiddle player, and of course, Doug Bond, our own Sandpoint favorite. So this is going to be a great concert.
Yeah, and I mean, you've been playing their music this last week or two, and they have some really fine songs. They're a newgrass band, right?
I would say that. They have an eclectic approach to bluegrass with those instruments, stand-up bass, banjo, amazing slide guitar, dobro they're called, and things like that. But one of the things I want the listeners to know is that on Friday at 3 p.m., they will be live here in the studios to give a little preview concert. And a little while ago, about 4 months ago, they came in the studio and all five of them came into this little room and were playing music, and it was pretty awesome. So you can listen to a little preview of the concert at 3 o'clock on Friday, but you can get your tickets now. Evans Brothers, Pedro's, Eichardt's, yes. And online at panada.org.
Yep.
Yeah, there you go. That's big. And I'll probably say it again today.
That's one not to miss right there. Speaking of music, the festival at Sandpoint announced their lineup this week. The festival, of course, is playing the first 2 weeks of August 4th through the 14th, and they have some great bands. I'm going to rattle them off. Bruce Hornsby is playing. Emmylou Harris is playing. She's actually played here once before. The Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Ben Harper, and then a musician who's called the Undisputed Queen of African Music, Angelique Kidjo, is playing as well. And of course, the Spokane Symphony plays as the finale concert each year. It's actually a pretty terrific lineup.
Right, and a little bluegrass band called Railroad Earth. I don't know if they're bluegrass. They're kind of that new grass sound. But I want our listeners to also know that we have all of that music loaded into our Autos Eclectic Mix. So throughout the day, you're going to be hearing it for the next months in advance. So.
A nice warm-up for the festival standpoint. I really think they did a great job lining those.
I do, too. Congratulations. They did good.
And other things going on around town. Well, you know, we'll get into the events calendar at the end of the show. As usual, there's a ton of things going on around town. I did want to mention that Idaho Gives happens tomorrow. That's May 5th. And that's a statewide program whereby lots of different philanthropic organizations, or I should say charitable organizations across the state are accepting gifts or contributions from people. And we have quite a number here in town that benefit from this. So if you're interested in giving and supporting your community, there's several Idaho Gives events happening around town. You can also go online. I think it's just idahogives.org and find local organizations that you can contribute to.
Right. And they have matching gifts for some of those donations.
That's right.
It's really a big deal.
It is a big deal statewide. Now we're going to get to our interview with the Idaho Senate candidates here in just a second. But I did want to mention that on the election front, that there's going to be an election forum on next Wednesday, May 11th. It's really going to be probably the last big forum that happens before the May 17th primary election. That's being sponsored by Sandpoint Online and Sandpoint Reader. It will be at the Sandpoint High School Auditorium beginning at 5:30 p.m. That's next Wednesday, May 11th. So I hope folks will be tuning into that.
And who's hosting that?
Sandpoint Online and the Sandpoint Reader.
Okay.
And I did want to mention it's going to be webcast live on sandpointonlive.com and the sandpointreader.com. So there's going to be a live streaming video that people will be able to watch. If you can't make it to the forum, you could tune in over the internet. So that's pretty cool.
That's great. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And with that, let's talk to our Idaho Senate candidates. Again, we have in the studio Idaho incumbent State Senator Sean Keel. For District 1. Sean, thanks for coming in.
Thanks again for the invitation and the opportunity to be here. I appreciate it.
We did invite your opponent, Glenn Rohr. He has elected not to come in and speak. Glenn did send a statement. It's a fairly long statement. We're going to read just the first part of it. We have discussed the whole policy on allowing candidates to duck coming in and answering questions. And just send in a statement. We're really not going to encourage that because it's not fair to the candidates that do come in to speak. The candidates in contested races are always invited to come in, and part of our mission to inform folks.
And I just want to say that the idea of having the candidates come into the live KRFY morning show is to have the conversation, and a written statement can be read on a website or somewhere else. So in the spirit of what we're trying to do here is to have that conversation live.
That's right. To be fair to the candidates and also to inform the listeners. That's really the bottom line here. I'm going to read the first part of Glenn's statement here, and here it is. I have spent this past year working hard to meet and talk with as many future constituents as possible throughout the district. I have attended three major forums and hosted numerous town hall and in-home meetings with individuals concerned about the direction the state is moving in. I'm a retired plant manager with over 32 years of management and leadership experience. Along with this, I am a retired military fighter pilot and a lifelong constitutional Republican. I will never vote for any bill that does not have a basis in our Constitution, federal or state, nor will I vote for any bill in conflict with these documents. Glenn goes on to talk about four or five different issues that he has a position on. We're not going to go into that, but I will say any listeners that would like to learn more about him or where he stands on issues can go to his website. It's roarer4idahosenate.com. That's R-O-H-R-E-R, numeral 4, idahosenate.com.
And will he be at the forum on the 11th?
He, as I understand, has not confirmed he's going to be at the forum on the 11th. So
that would have been another opportunity to hear some of the stands that he takes.
Yeah. I hope he does show up in the interest of informing the voters. With that, Sean, thanks again for coming in. This is Sean Keel, our incumbent state senator. And we're going to run this as if you did have an opponent here, which means we are going to ask you to keep some of your remarks brief. Typically, we like to start out with open mic for a couple minutes here to tell folks a little bit about who you are and why you're running and why they should vote for you.
Well, thank you again for this opportunity to be here. I really appreciate spending time with you and your listeners. And it is an excellent opportunity to reacquaint voters with their incumbent senator and to give me an opportunity to talk about why I am running for re-election and I'm hoping for the voters' support. I have am the state senator for the area. I have a great deal of experience. I've been blessed by the voters to have been reelected to that position and am now serving as co-chairman of the budget committee and am number one in seniority in the state Senate. That is new for our area. We've not ever that I can find in history had the chairmanship of the Senate Finance Committee and having the number one senior member of the Senate is something that this area has never had. And that is a benefit to us. It makes sure that our issues get put on the table. And if there are things like funding roads, increased funding for our K-12 system, public schools, that puts me in the driver's seat to help move those decisions in a positive way. And that's what I offer in this campaign. A little bit of background. I have worked and I've lived here most of my life now. My husband and I have been married 29 years, and we've raised both our children here. They are now out of college and have left the nest, so to speak. One of our sons is in Idaho and raising his family here. The other one has left the state. My background is in the business community. I work in the private sector for Associated Logging Contractors. And I have close to 30 years of experience in the business private business sector, currently managing an organization that provides insurance and logging safety consulting for the logging contractors of this area and across the state. And my track record of service has included moving transportation projects forward, the Dover Bridge, the Sandpoint Bypass, projects in Priest River and Bonner's Ferry from here to Hope and Clark Fork, and then working in our public school system to try to retain qualified teachers, to try to do better by our kids and make sure that when they graduate from high school, they've got the skills they need to be successful in life. Increasing funding from the state level has been something that I've been a part of. Every dollar from the state relieves the need for the local districts to ask for supplemental levies or levies on the property taxpayers. Not only that, I believe constitutionally, it's a responsibility to fund our public schools, but it's also a moral obligation in my mind for our society to continue to grow and prosper. We need an educated education population, and the K-12 K-12 public school system provides that. So I don't know if I'm going over any time limit or not, but I am honored to be in service and would like the honor of continuing to be in service.
Thank you, Sean. So you're number one in seniority in the state Senate. And are you the first woman to hold that position?
I am, actually. And I'm the longest serving woman state senator in Idaho's history and the longest serving state senator for our area as well.
So. Yeah, well, that's a little bit of history there. I had read a story in Sandpoint Magazine about that. Right. So let's jump into some of the issues here. And let's start out with education. You did mention education. The legislature this year passed a 7.4% increase in public school funding. Yet, Idaho is just ranked 47th out of the 50 states in its expenditures per pupil. So the question would be, should the state increase its education funding? If you believe so, where will more funding come from? If you don't believe it should, and with educational quality an ongoing concern, how can the state improve education?
Thank you for that question, Chris. I believe that the state needs to continue to increase funding for public education. As I mentioned before, it's the cornerstone of a sound society and making sure that our children have the opportunity to become educated so that they can prosper, have an opportunity to be successful in life. And that will help stabilize our society and keep it going into the future. And certainly the state of Idaho, as many other states, suffered from the economic downturn. And we were able to buffer the K-12 system from cuts for much of the downturn because we had rainy day accounts that we were able to...
A budget surplus, basically, that had been saved up over the years.
Basically, yes. And we actually made a conscious decision to save...
To have a rainy day fund.
$300 million to $400 million. At the time, to much criticism. Mm-hmm. But that really saved our bacon, so mm-hmm. to speak, because it allowed us to keep the public school system intact for much of the downturn. We're doing a number of things to try to improve the quality of our schools, and those do take an investment of money. We have, after the so-called Luna laws, we've done what I've pushed for a long time, and that's to bring many of the stakeholders at the state level and at the local level as well. The diverse interests around public schools to the table and try to chart a course of where we need to go in the future. What is it that we are looking for our kids to have when they get out of high school? And what is it that we're looking for from our teachers? What accountability measures are we looking for? And so we've kind of embarked on a roadmap, so to speak. And with that comes commitments in increased funding. Increased funding for our teachers, increased funding for our staff. But money isn't everything. But it is helpful to try to achieve those goals, particularly when you look at things like what we initiated this year. We revamped our effort to make sure that kids read at grade level by grade 3. And if they don't, to intervene and try to get them the help that they need to try to bring them up to that level. What we had been doing was lagging behind, wasn't meeting those targets. And so we've revamped that. We put about $9 million into that effort to, again, try to make sure that those children are reading at the grade level by third grade, because our experience shows us that if we don't do that, then we are likely to lose them through the high school years. And so those type of things take investment. And I think that part of the question that you asked there was, where's the money going to come from? And
there's the $64 question.
Right, exactly. Idaho, in my view, a lot of that is coming from the economic rebound that we're seeing. There's still obviously much room to gain in our rural areas with rebound in economic growth. However, that being said, Idaho is one of the is leading the nation actually in the number of jobs it's adding and its rebound out of the downturn in the economy. And with that comes an increase in revenue to the state. More taxes are being paid as businesses grow and people have jobs and they pay their taxes. And that gives us more money at the state level to work with. And it comes down to our budgeting process and how the budget committee, which I co-chair, places those priorities. And my goal, as it was when I was vice chairman, but it remains as a co-chairman, is to make sure that we continue to hold K-12 education as a priority for our spending.
One of the questions I have in thinking about what you're saying, is it your experience that the Senate is pretty unified in their support of keeping education in the state of Idaho as a priority?
I would say that when you look at the overall votes, that the entire legislature votes that way. Certainly there are folks that vote no on education budgets, but the majority vote to support education budgets.
So Idaho has been consistently ranking down in the bottom five of expenditures per pupil for years now. And part of that, I'm sure, is due to the fact that we have a lower average per capita income. So we can't generate as much money maybe for our education system. But do other states have a different funding formula that lets them put more money towards their education than Idaho does?
A couple things. I sometimes think that we focus too much on how much money we spend per pupil. I'm not sure that that's entirely a fair picture. It's certainly a piece of the picture, in my view, because money does equate to being able to do more things in the classroom. But it's not everything. So that being said, to try to answer your question, other states have a bigger tax base. They have more people, more population, bigger economy. So that would drive that spending up to a degree. And then every state's kind of, it seems to be different in how their funding formulas are driven. And then I would say that there's some states that are spending quite a bit of more money. They're up at the top of the list in states that are spending more money per pupil, but they are not necessarily meeting academic goals and preparing their kids. And so I think you also have to look at those type of measurements as well.
And we don't rank in the bottom five in our student performance. We're actually, I think, basically in the middle of the country rankings that way.
Exactly.
So we get more bang for our buck, you might say.
Yes, that's what I would
say.
And
that must be the dedicated teachers. Hooray.
You know, the teachers are in the classroom are my heroes. Mm-hmm. They day in and day out, they're the ones that are responsible for the kids. And sadly, in this day and age, they're doing much more than reading, writing, and arithmetic. They're really taking care of the child. But that's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned that it's not just, in your estimation, it's not just the money per pupil that makes a difference. What are some of the other things that can equate to success for a student to move on and to have a well-rounded education in Idaho?
Thank you for that question. It starts with the family and the family being involved in the student's education and it being a part of it, not just simply sending the child off to school, but being a part. Volunteering in the classroom, helping them with their homework when they get home, interacting with the teacher. That family component is a key piece. Also key is the teacher in the classroom and making sure that the teacher has the tools needed, has the materials, isn't having to pay for materials out of their own pockets, has the tools that they need, and then has the knowledge and the passion for teaching those children. And That comes with training. And also, we need to do a better job at providing mentoring for our teachers. And that's one of the things that we're working on in our roadmap, is to provide more funding for mentoring for teachers. But trying to keep those teachers in Idaho that are the most qualified and the most passionate, that really is key. And then the support of the community is also important. Valuing public education, valuing our teachers as a community, and being supportive of the system and being involved. Those are all key pieces.
Mm-hmm. Another thought I had is, I know here in Sandpoint, I don't know if it's statewide, there's the kindergarten readiness program. Mm-hmm. And a key component to that is the parents' involvement. It's not about getting the child ready. It's really about the family, working together, supporting that child to move into kindergarten ready.
That program is really a great program. And the Panhandle Alliance for Education is a great organization, a great foundation here that raises money from private donations to help that program succeed. And that our foundation, the Panhandle Alliance for Education, is replicated. There are several of those organizations across the state, and they're serving a great need. And that kindergarten readiness and programs like that are exactly that, trying to inspire the families, give families the tools that they need to make sure that the child is ready to learn when they hit first grade. And that really is key. And I think sometimes parents want to do the right thing, but don't necessarily know what that is. And so that's very helpful.
And I'll just throw in that is a program by the Panhandle Alliance for Education. If we do have any parents of young children listening, even just from birth up to a kindergarten, they could go to readysandpoint.org to get more information about that program. They provide free books and tutoring to the parents on how to get their kids started in education. And it's really important because, throw on my two cents here, because if kids start out in school behind, they stay behind almost their entire school career. So starting in early with your child gives them a real boost up. Let's ask another question concerning, it's relating to education. Sean, the legislature approved a bill to expressly permit using the Bible for academic study in public schools, even though state law already permits using the Bible for academic purposes. Governor Butch Otter vetoed it because he said it was in direct contravention to the Idaho Constitution and would have just resulted in costly and losing litigation. Did you support or oppose this bill to use the Bible in public schools?
I voted yes for the bill. The bill actually said that religious texts could be used in schools to teach in a variety of subject matter. And there was history and several other topics that were expressly listed. And it said Bible, but it also said and other religious texts. And the current law today actually requires that the Bible be read every day in school. And so...
I'm sorry. Come again on that?
That's exactly right. So today, the law says that verses from the Bible will be read every day in our public schools. That's the law today. And I see looks of surprise. And I shared that surprise because I was not aware of that either until this bill came in front of us and I saw the deleted language. And I thought, really? That's existing law? Hmm. Went to the law book, looked it up. That is indeed what the law says. And I was sure there's a bigger
Idaho
story there.
Law.
But it is Idaho state law today that Bible verses be read every day in the class. And so when I looked at this bill, when it got to the Senate floor, the bill said that Bible and other religious texts could be used, not shall be used, not read every day, could be used, and could be used in context of teaching history and some other subjects where it seemed like there could be relevancy in a history class, for example, to talk about the Christianity history, the history of the Bible, Christians, but also talk about other religions as well and other religious texts and put those into a historical context, which would give the student a better understanding of the world around us. And I saw value in that.
Do you think this law that was vetoed by Butch Otter, saying that the Bible and other religious texts was going to then take, you know, put the other law that's currently on the books away? I mean, did it?
I think a couple of things. I think in this discussion, it's been lost that current law says that the Bible should be read every day, shall be read every day in school. That kind of has been lost. And I think that also has, that statute has been overridden by a Supreme Court case. So it's one of those things that we need to clean up, because I think the federal level decisions have said, you know, that's not right, or that those decisions have been made legally. So, but that now is still in place. That's still there. It's contradictory to what I think the direction at the federal level has been. But, I agree with the governor that the legislation, although it wasn't ever, hardly ever was it reported the whole part. The focus was on the Bible, but the reporting didn't. Was on the Bible, it wasn't on and other religious texts and in context with history and all these other topics. But I do know that there was a great deal of concern about it. And it would, I agree that with the governor that it would have created legal challenges that would have ended up in court and would have eaten up precious money that we could have been spending someplace else.
I wonder if some of the litigation would have been if the other text was the Quran or some other text was also being read or not taught as anything, but just looked at as the text of some other, you know, nationality. Is that where the litigation thought was?
You know, I think that once Idahoans understood all that was in the law, and as it began to be applied, that folks on all sides of the debate would be engaged.
And I want to remind our listeners that this is the 88.5 KRFY Morning Show with Chris and Susie as your hosts. And today we are speaking with candidates for the Idaho State Senate District 1 seat, which is coming up for vote in just on May 17th at the primary. And actually, this vote will decide who the winner is, because there is no Democratic candidate. Is there a Democratic candidate that's facing you?
So what will happen is there is actually a person that has filed on the Democratic ticket named Steve Tanner.
Oh, okay. That's right.
And Steve has also run in the past as a Republican. And as I understand it, the Democratic Party has launched a write-in campaign for Brian Orr, former county commissioner here in Bonner County. So there's a contest in the Democratic Party.
And well, you know, we don't have good information on this, because I heard that Brian was not going to run because he had, in fact, registered as a Republican most recently.
Okay.
So I'll mention the reason we didn't focus on the Democratic side of the ticket for this series of interviews is because it was uncontested. So it's not going to be, there's not going to be any race on the Democratic side in the primary, as far as I know at this point, unless another Democratic candidate is come forward to run as a write-in. We'll clarify that, actually. We have one more of these shows before we... before the election next Wednesday, when we'll be talking with the sheriff candidates.
But so I guess it would be safe to say that at the moment there is someone running on the Democratic ticket, so there would be a fall challenge.
Okay, all right.
And at that time in the fall, in October, we will have you. those that are in the election, the general election, back into the studio for more conversation.
For the contested races.
Great.
So, okay. Let's push on to some other issues here. And Sean, you talked a little bit about the economy and the fact that the Idaho economy has been improving, as much of the country has as well. And of course, the economy and job creation are enduring issues of concern. Do you consider it an important issue for the Idaho legislature to deal with? And if so, the question would be, what specific actions would you advocate or support to improve the economy and job creation here in Idaho?
I very much believe that the economy is important, and that the state government has a role in trying to make sure that we have a business climate that's conducive to businesses being able to grow and want to grow here and want to stay in operation here in Idaho. And there's a number of things that we've done that I've been involved with over the last few years to try to grow those opportunities. We've done some tax policy that gives companies that grow jobs, add jobs at a certain wage level, rebates on their taxes that they've paid to the state. That's a net gain to us because we have the jobs, the added jobs, good paying jobs, and we will have added tax revenue even with the rebate. And it is a rebate, so they paid taxes and we're refunding some of that back. But the overall gain is in jobs for our communities and tax revenue to the state as well, which helps in funding things like schools, for example. So that's one area. We have reinvigorated some of our workforce training programs to help businesses and business sectors have trained workforce, trained labor, help them with some of their training needs. And we also continue to work on infrastructure things such as sewer line extensions and water extensions, trying to work on internet speeds and those type of infrastructure things that businesses need, a good transportation system that businesses need to be viable, particularly in our rural areas. And so I think it is really critical, and I think there is a proper role of the state government and local governments to take to try to help businesses to grow and add those jobs.
When you mentioned earlier that we are increasing jobs in the state of Idaho, what are some of the areas and types of jobs and businesses that are coming in to Idaho, and what type do we hope for?
You know, I think every community is a little different. I know here we continue to be supportive of our homegrown companies like Lighthouse to continue to grow and to continue to be headquartered here. Companies like Quest Aircraft, Cochava, which is in the high-tech industry. We have aerospace companies in addition to Quest. There's Aeroset in Peace River. We also continue to have a solid natural resource industry with companies like Idaho Forest Group and Stimson Lumber operating. And then in other areas of the state, we're seeing companies like Chobani in the Twin Falls area that is really a tremendous success story and a wonderful coup for Idaho. Even though the jobs are in the Twin Falls area, the exposure for Idaho, the promotion of Idaho in a world market, really, and the benefit because that company and its employees pay taxes to the state that helps support all of our infrastructure needs is important. We've also got craft breweries that are growing, so companies here like Laughing Dog and McDuff Brewery, our wineries are growing, and so we have actually some pretty vibrant sectors that are growing, which is exciting. And so I see again, the state role is to try to make sure that we have a business-friendly climate, but also that we're promoting good-paying jobs as well.
Do you know why Chobani chose Idaho and the Twin Falls area to headquarter out of? Because, yeah, as you say, was it the business climate that was created?
My understanding of their decision was that the state was, we were able to put a package together that had all their permitting process in a one-stop shop kind of thing. We were able to put together help with sewer extensions, water access, which is key in the Twin Falls area in particular. And then we also have a robust dairy industry. Milk producers. We're one of the bigger producers of milk and dairy products in the country as well. And so close resource to a good product that is the base of their product and a labor force.
To let people know, their product is Greek yogurt. Yeah.
Right.
Greek style yogurt.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. I apologize. I thought everybody knew what Giovanni was. And so it was. Partly the raw material that goes into the yogurt availability, the closeness of it, but then that the local governments and the state governments were very responsive and made it very, very possible for them to get started very quickly with little red tape.
Okay, another question here. Let's talk about healthcare. We currently have about an estimated 78,000 Idahoans that make a little bit too much money to get help from Medicaid, but they don't make nearly enough money to purchase health insurance. It's called the Medicaid gap. The Idaho legislature saw more pressure this year to expand Medicaid and provide insurance options for these people. But it didn't pass. It looked like there was something in the works there, but it looks like it went down as well late in the session. What is your position on this, the folks that are these 78,000 Idahoans that don't have health care and can't qualify for Medicaid?
I believe that we have to do something. We have to make sure that our fellow Idahoans have access to health care. And on the fiscal responsible side, fiscal conservative side of me, it actually makes fiscally sound sense to develop a program, whether it's Medicaid expansion in its pure form, or it's some sort of Idaho hybrid version of a program. We need to do that, and here's why: we will save. We have the potential to save $31 million at the state level, that state and county level. So people today that are in that gap population, they'll put off taking care of their diabetes. They'll put off regular routine screenings, mammograms, any other kind of regular tests that people that have access to healthcare have. And so oftentimes they will be in an emergency situation when they need to get, they'll let something go until it's an emergency. And then they have to access the most expensive care in the emergency room. And that's picked up by us, the rest of the taxpayers. It's either picked up by us on our property taxes through the County Indigent Fund, or it's picked up by the hospital in their write-off of care. But those costs are passed on to everybody else that uses the hospital. And it's picked up in the increase in insurance costs that those who have health insurance pay. And so... So really, it's fiscally conservative, and it's the right thing to do to make sure that folks have access to health care and in a timely fashion and in a manner that includes preventative care, so that people that have diseases like diabetes, for example, get the preventative care up front, which can alleviate the catastrophic type of things that happen later on in that particular disease or those type of diseases.
So you mentioned that the state could save $31 million, and that is by signing on to the federal government's Medicaid expansion program, which has a fund for states to do this expansion. Is that how that works? Can you clarify that, please?
So even with a hybrid Idaho type plan, like the Healthy Idaho plan,
which was discussed in this session,
correct? And it's been discussed by two now different work groups that the governor has put together. But our current program through the state, we have a catastrophic healthcare program at the state level, which spends about $22 million a year. The county indigent fund spends about $18 million a year. The county spend about $4 million to administer that program. We have a behavioral health program through Department of Health and Welfare that spends about $9 million. And so all of those things would go away. They would be rolled into the Healthy Idaho plan. There's talk about taking the money from the one other model is taking the money from the federals, which would be a 90%. You know, they would pay 90% and we would pay 10%. Keep in mind that it's our tax dollars, whether it's federal or state. Buy that gap population insurance policies. And so, again, the savings are there. They come from doing things better and utilizing our tax dollars that we send to the federal government here.
So... It seems like an obvious thing for the legislature to deal with, to get health insurance for the 78,000 people that are underinsured and save a bunch of money. Is there any prospect that this is going to move forward in the next session of legislature?
I do think that what I saw this session was a growing recognition that we have a problem and that we have an obligation to try to do things differently. And to get folks access to healthcare, I think that we heard from a number of Idahoans with just really distressing stories of from death, from a routine, if there is such a thing, asthma attack that could have been prevented, loss of bankruptcies due to healthcare costs. That were catastrophic in nature. And I think as more Idaho citizens have shared those things and that they're working people, these are families that are working mm-hmm. two and three jobs to make ends meet. These aren't folks that somehow occasionally conjure up this folks that might be living off the system and sitting on the couch eating bonbons all day. These are people that are active in our communities. They're working jobs, but they simply are in this gap. And I think as more legislators got their minds around and understood from their constituents who these people are and what exactly the problems are, there was a growing desire to do something. Now, what something is the debate.
And it's curious why, if it's a win-win, people are healthy, they're still working, they're paying taxes if they get sick because they have no health insurance, then we also lose that tax revenue. Where is the argument for not, and is it going to come back up?
Well, I think, you know, the other side of the issue, which, you know, if my opponent was here, I'm sure, but the concern is that we're growing government. It's an entitlement program, another entitlement program that will be costly in the long run. Yes, it will come back up because it's clear, at least to me and other legislators like me, that again, it's actually the more fiscally conservative thing to do on that side. And then again, these folks need healthcare access, and they are the working poor.
Okay. Well, we're going to be running out of time before too long, but we have time for a couple more questions, I think. The legislature in this past session passed a new law that allows handgun owners over the age of 21 to carry a concealed weapon inside the city limits without a permit. Did you favor or oppose that?
I voted for it. It was interesting educational experience for me. I didn't realize that for a long, for I guess since the state was founded, that if you were outside the city limits, you can carry concealed and open without a permit. And so then it was like, well, so what's the difference? If you can carry openly and concealed in the county without a permit, what's the difference within a city? And then what does it do for a law-abiding citizen who lives, for example, in Sagal and wants to go to the stores out in Ponderay, and they come through Sandpoint, and they have a concealed weapon on them as they're coming in? They forget about it let's assume for a minute that they forget that they have it, and they become illegal when they hit Sandpoint and Ponderay, and it just kind of seemed like a patchwork. So
I'm just curious real quick. I'm sure you have a good question too, Chris, but what is the argument to not have a permit? I mean, what's the big deal to just make sure people know what they're doing? It's just a permit.
But I think you heard the governor express some reservations and concerns about making sure that training was somehow included. But folks that were proponents of this legislation feel very passionately that gun rights aren't something that are supposed to be regulated.
Okay. Well, we are coming near the end here, and I throw out a kind of a broader question. What do you think are the most significant issues the legislature will take up in this next term, next 2 years, that will have specific impacts on Bonner County residents?
Well, I think the issue that we were just talking about relative to health care will be a significant issue. And again, that is significant for Bonner County and Boundary County in Legislative District 1, because we do have thousands of people that fall into that gap population, and they are in need of health care, and they are showing up. We are paying for those people through our state taxes and our insurance for those that have insurance policies, and on our property taxes with the local county indigent fund. And so that discussion will come up, and hopefully we'll come to some resolution. Hopefully we'll craft something that works for Idaho. And continued work on moving our K-12 education system forward in a manner that makes sure we have a quality system that's properly funded and has accountability in place, and it provides our students with an opportunity for success when they move on from high school, whether that's into college or into a career. And then continued work on our economy and trying to add jobs and our transportation as well. Those are key. Obviously, there's other issues as well.
Okay. And with that, Sean, we're at the end of our time. Would you like to take a minute to just make a closing statement and tell people why they should vote for you? And remember to give us your contact information.
Oh, thank you. Thank you again for this opportunity to be here. I truly appreciate visiting with you and the questions, and visiting with your listening audience as well. My website is www.seankeo.com, and you'll find quite a bit of information about my legislative service, my priorities for the service, what I'm hearing from constituents. You'll also find a tab on there called Just the Facts, which sets out some facts that are contrary to some things voters might be hearing out there, and I encourage you to visit that page as well. What I offer the voters is the opportunity for continued responsible representation, focus on the issues that matter to us, like healthcare, like roads, like our education system, and the seniority that counts. And I know that that also being there 20 years and gaining that seniority is a challenge for some, because it's a long time. But at the same time, it is a benefit to us because it puts us at the leadership table, it puts our priorities in play, And as co-chair of the budget committee, I am able to make decisions that benefit our communities here. And that is what I have to offer. I'd be honored to have the voter support on May 17th in the Republican primary.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Hon. Thank you so much. Very informative. We appreciate your coming in today. And this is 88.5 KRFY. We just have a few moments to say one or two things.
Okay. Well, on the election front, again, another reminder that there will be a candidates forum next Wednesday, May 11th at the Sandpoint High School Auditorium. It begins at 5:30 p.m., should run till about 8 p.m. That's sponsored by Sandpoint Online and the Sandpoint Reader. If you can't make it to the forum that evening, it will be webcast live at sandpointonline.com and the sandpointreader.com. So it's another opportunity to see the candidates, actually question them yourselves, because they do take questions from the audience. And they'll be able to do that online, by the way. People that are watching online will have a chat feature so they can forward questions to the candidates.
Oh, that's very exciting.
And so I hope people will take advantage of that.
Yep. And this interview that we had this morning with our state Senator Sean Keogh will be available at krfy.org later in the day as a podcast. So you can listen to it if you missed it or listen to it again. We just want to remind our listeners that this Friday night, it's the KRFY benefit concert at the Panada with the Little Smokies. And right now we're going to say goodbye and hear a Little Smokies song called California. We hope you have a beautiful day.
Yes. Have a good week.